This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And happy Monday. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you in the second hour of our program today. 1 hour from now, we're going to be talking with Dr. Patrick Michaels. The global warming deniers got together and had a conference. Yeah. I want to find out what happened. What conclusions did they come to? At what point? How much, to what extent are they beating each other up? It should be interesting to find out about. Paul Hannum is going to be here to talk, following that, to talk about how green jobs could actually save the American economy. In our third hour, we're going to be talking with Paul Waldman. He, along with David Brock, who runs MediaMatters.org, which is just a great website, keeping the media honest. They have a new book out, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. And we're going to be discussing that topic. And Tim Newman, the communications director for the ILRF, is going to be with us about forced and child labor in the agricultural sector here in the United States. So a lot of stuff going on in the program today. We'll be taking your calls throughout the hours, throughout our program. But I want to start with a question about the Olympics. This was a big story worldwide over the weekend. And 60 Minutes did a piece last night on the sovereign wealth funds of China that seemingly had nothing to do with the Olympics, but in my opinion, in a way, has everything to do with it as well. First of all, the setup on this, I mean, the news story, the news hook for the day that is causing people to be talking about this all over the world, is that the Olympic torch is supposed to be lit, you know, at the beginning, and then it travels all around the world, and then it ends up, you know, in the city where the Olympics are going to be held, and it burns continuously throughout the Olympics. And, you know, this sacred torch, right, to quote Chinese officials, the sacred torch. Yesterday, in France, twice the torch was put out. Twice it was put out. In order to avoid protest, they had to smuggle it out of buses, and apparently they thought that it would be, you know, dangerous having a burning torch on a bus. And so they put the thing out, hopped on the bus, and then they relit it. And frankly, in my mind, that's symbolic. There's just an extraordinary symbology there that has to do with a number of different things. First of all, we have and our question for the day, actually, let me just get right to this, is should we boycott the Olympic Games? Should the United States boycott the Games either full tilt, like Jimmy Carter did with the Soviet Union, and just not show up at all, or like Sarkozy in France and Angela Merkel of Germany are talking about, simply not showing up for, you know, where the dignitaries show up for the opening day events. And Bush has said, well, it's just a sporting event to me. Well, you know, of course, he doesn't understand these things. But should the United States, should we consider boycotting the Olympic Games? Should we even consider moving them to a different venue? There's been a proposal. Hey, let's take them to Athens, for example. You know, they can deal with it. Should that be done? And should it be done in support of the people of Darfur and the South Sudan, where they have found oil and the Chinese are in there arming the people who are killing the people of Darfur and South Sudan, the government of Khartoum, and buying the oil and pumping the oil out? Number one. Or should we be doing it in solidarity with His Holiness the Dalai Lama of Tibet in protest of the violence against the people of Tibet? Or number three, should we as Americans be protesting the destruction of human rights in China as a consequence of the Chinese government? And I'd like to just, you know, briefly talk about each one of those three things, because there's some real issues here. Let's start with the last one. What China has demonstrated, and you know, I would say to some extent Singapore demonstrated this 10, 20, 30 years ago, but it really wasn't noticed on the world stage. but China is doing it in a way that it's impossible to ignore, is the fact that capitalism does not mean democracy, which I realize is a horrible revelation for those people, for the libertarians, for the objectivists, for the neoconservatives who believe that democracy and capitalism are the same thing. Ayn Rand made this horrible mistake. You know, she grew up in the Soviet Union. Her father lost his pharmacy when she was 9 years old to the Bolshevik Revolution. She studied political science at the University of Kiev and then came over to the United States and made the mistake of thinking that capitalism was democracy. And it's not. Democracy is a form of governance. Capitalism is a form of economic organization. And now, in the Soviet Union, communism was both. It was both a form of governance and a form of political organization. But what's happened in China, and as I mentioned, you know, I mentioned Singapore, what has happened in China is that you can have despotism, you can have tyranny, you can have, you know, they call it communism. It's really just tyranny and capitalism. They can coexist just fine, thank you very much. And really, I mean, you look back at England, you know, 300 years ago. And this is what the founders were looking at. They were saying, well, you know, you've got a highly laissez-faire capitalist society and tyranny. And we rebelled against it. We revolted. We overthrew it. So there's this widespread belief in America, particularly among conservatives, that somehow if you have capitalism, you're going to have democracy. I remember about a decade, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was in Singapore. And I've written 7 books on attention deficit disorder, and I used to do a lot of teaching and consulting on that topic and on schools and education and how to fix schools and things. I was doing a tour of Pacific Rim countries. I'd been in Japan, I'd been down in Australia, and there was a group in Singapore that sponsored me to come and talk about how to improve the schools. And they had put me up in the I believe it was the Peninsula. It was one of the fanciest hotels in town. And it was a very, very nice 5-star hotel. And I was speaking to this group, and somebody in the group, there was a question and answer, and somebody in the group said, how do we, you know, what's your best suggestion for the fastest way that we can produce the kind of changes that you're suggesting in our school system so that it'll work better for all of our kids? And I said, political action. I said, get politically involved, which is my standard answer here in the United States. You know, talk to your elected officials. Get them to do something. Tell them if they don't, you're not going to support them. And the room went absolutely silent. And I thought, whoa, what did I say? Now, this is a country where, you know, when you show up at the airport, there's this big sign that says, if you have any drugs, you will be executed, which should be kind of it should have been a clue. The taxi driver, when he was driving us around the country, had a little thing in his car where if he went over a certain speed, whatever the speed limit was, his car would start going ding, 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 ding. So he would immediately slow down. If you chew gum and spit it on the sidewalk, you will be arrested. So anyhow, afterwards, the organizer of the conference said, I wish you hadn't said that to get politically active. He said, that's just something you don't say in Singapore. It's a very dangerous thing to say. And I went back to my hotel, and we had dinner, and about 3 hours after this thing, I went back to my hotel, and somebody had completely trashed my hotel room. They had opened all the drawers, flipped them upside down. They had taken the mattress off the box springs of the bed. The bed was all, I mean, it was like in my face. You know, we know you're here. And I went to the hotel management. I said, you know, what's the deal? And they said, well, you know, the police were here. And it's just, I mean, and that's like minor police state tactics compared to what goes on in China. In China, if somebody speaks out, they end up in prison or they end up dead. They end up being an involuntary organ donor. So there's that part of it. Then there's what's going on with the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Tibet. Back about 10 years ago, I was invited to spend a week along with a group of 27 people, as I recall it was. It was called the Synthesis Dialogues. And there's been a movie made about this. The audio tapes are out there. New Dimensions Radio, Michael Toms, audio tape most of the thing. There are some links, I think, from our website to his. You can find it at newdimensions.org. There's tapes of this. We spent a week with the Dalai Lama. And, you know, four of the 5 days that we were there, this 6 or 7, but the 5 official days that we were there, Four of those days, we spent every afternoon sitting and talking with him. And we were in this town of Dharamsala. And Dharamsala was a town that was created when the Dalai Lama came here. It means refuge in the local language. And of the 100,000 people in Dharamsala, virtually all of them are people who had fled Tibet. And they all had these horror stories. I mean, several people actually arrived while we were there, walking over the Himalayas, where they had lost family members, people had been shot, people had been murdered, many of them trying to make their way to Dharamsala, dying, literally, lions and tigers and bears, at least tigers and bears eating them, soldiers killing them. I mean, it's horrific. It's what's going on in China.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Simple-minded and the uninformed can be easily led astray. And those that cannot connect the dots, hey, look the other way. People believe what they want to believe when it makes no sense at all. So be careful of those who kill in Jesus' name. You don't believe in killing at all. Walk tall. Yeah, walk on.
20 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. You can find out more at teamster.org. So I'm in Dharamsala in India, in this town way up in the Himalaya Mountains. It was a 14-hour bus ride up from New Delhi. And there's some interesting stories around that, but it's a whole other thing. And McLeod Ganj is the next town over. It's like 5 miles away, and that's where the Dalai Lama's actual residence is. We spent the last day there with him at his private residence. But the first 4 days we spent at the institute in Dharamsala. And there was, and I talked with a number of the Tibetans who were living there. These were all people who had fled Tibet after the Chinese invasion, after the Dalai Lama was forced out. And one of them told me the story about how his brother, his younger brother, had been given a John Lennon t-shirt by a tourist. And he wore it. And the police thought that the picture of John Lennon was a picture of the Dalai Lama because of the round glasses. And they executed his brother. And his family went into hiding, and he and his family fled to out of Tibet, crossed the Himalayas to Dharamsala, which is why he was there. And several members of his family did not survive the trip. There were robbers along the way who killed one of them. There was one of them died from frostbite. I mean, it was just I heard story after story, these horrific stories. The some estimates as many as a million Tibetans. The population of Tibet went from 6 to 5 million. As many as a million Tibetans were murdered by the Chinese, as the Chinese were moving ethnic Chinese into Tibet to take control of the economic infrastructure and the cultural infrastructure of the country, and banning the religion, the Tibetan Buddhism that is practiced by the Dalai Lama. So, should we be boycotting the Olympics in support of His Holiness the Dalai Lama? And then the third one is what's going on in Sudan. You know, those of you who've been listening to the program for a while know that three weeks ago I did this show along with three of my colleagues, Joe Madison, the Black Eagle, the African-American talk show host out of Washington, D.C., really helped put the thing together. He this was his fourth trip to the Darfur region of southern Sudan. It was actually put together by Ellen Ratner with Talk Radio News and Talkers Magazine, Michael Harrison. But anyhow, Joe Madison was with me. Rusty Humphries was with me. Jack Rice, a talk show host in Minneapolis, was with me. And Rusty Humphries, the conservative on Talk Radio News. And the four of us went, and this was the first press trip that Joe had been able to put together in years. I mean, he'd gone to Geraldo, he'd gone to CBS, ABC, NBC, all of these. And he said, you know, you've got to see what's going on in South Sudan. You've got to see what's going on in Darfur. There's a genocide going on. It's the world's worst refugee crisis. And he said, everybody said, well, you know, can you get me a hotel? No, there are no hotels. You have to sleep in a pup tent on the ground. Well, can I take a shower? No, there's no water. Well, can I get, you know, is there a restaurant I can? No, there are no restaurants. There is no food. You have to bring your own food. Can I get in and out on the same day? No, there's not even an airport. You have to fly into a dirt strip in a cargo plane, strapped to the inside of the cargo plane with a couple of thousands of pounds of food flying around. Well, is it kind of dangerous? Well, yeah. You know, it's three UN aid workers were murdered last week just 30 miles from where we were. We were driving around trucks full of supplies. They were driving around trucks full of supplies. And we did our show live by satellite phone from that region. Those of you who've been listening for several weeks remember that. Here's a report. This was on CBS News' website. It's an AP story. It sounds like a place stricken by a biblical plague. Disease after unimaginable disease all come to rest in one pitiful region of a vast African country. Worms oozing out of people's feet. Two kinds of flies whose bites cause death in bizarre ways. A baffling syndrome that throws children into seizures. While some of these devastating diseases can be found scattered around the world's poorest places, it is only in southern Sudan that they are all seen together in one country at the same time. The area is a hotbed of exotic diseases, from the feared Ebola virus, which was first identified here and in Zaire, to nodding syndrome. One of the most stubborn afflictions in the south is guinea worm disease. People get it by swallowing water fleas that live in their drinking water. The flea carries parasitic larvae, which reproduce inside the human body after about 100 days. The infection is unnoticeable for about a year. Then grown worms migrate through the body, emerging after they bore holes through the skin, usually at the top of the feet. The wound becomes an ulcer, and it can take months for the worm to come out, causing terrible pain and incapacitation. Victims sometimes tie twigs to the worm, hoping to speed its exit. There are no drugs to treat the disease. One of the more deadly illnesses is sleeping sickness. Everyone dies. More people die from this in southern Sudan than AIDS. River blindness, another worm. It's a foot and a half long. Lives in the body for up to 14 years before it kills people. And then there's another one, this disease related to leprosy called the Buruli ulcer. There's a picture on my website, TomHartmann.com. Go over to our blog, click Tom's blog, and just scroll down at the very bottom. You'll see a picture of a girl with Buruli ulcer that we saw in the camp. I mean, all of these diseases. What does this have to do with China? Well, China is exploring for oil in South Sudan, and the government in Khartoum has given them pretty much the exclusive license. And so Khartoum now, the government of the north, is engaging in a systematic genocide and clearing of land, so in part so that the Chinese can more easily explore for, drill, and pump out oil from this region. There may be as much oil in South Sudan as Iraq. Should we boycott the Olympics over that?
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Three minutes past the hour. Just the strangest stuff going on out there in the world, I'll tell you. Sometimes you think it's just crazy. The Mortgage Bankers Association. You know them, the Association of Mortgage Bankers. Well, a year ago, they issued a press release saying that they were thrilled to sign a contract to buy a fancy new headquarter building in downtown Washington, D.C. Now they're closing on the building, and the problem they have, well, this is from the Washington Post. Scheduled to close on the building in the coming weeks, the association will have to pay millions of dollars more than it would have a year ago when it contracted to buy the 160,000-square-foot structure. Millions of dollars it is now less able to afford. Isn't this ironic? The Mortgage Bankers Association can't pay the mortgage on its own new building. It is downright strange. Okay, back to, and we'll take your calls on this, back to this issue of whether or not the U.S. should boycott the Beijing Olympics. First of all, I'm not suggesting that we should not have our athletes participate. I'm not an advocate of that far a boycott. I think that punishes the athletes. But I do think that George Bush should not attend the opening ceremony. I think that, and the reason why I would think that, the reason why if they were being held in Germany during the 30s, as they were. I mean, the Olympics in 36, they were awarded to Germany before Hitler came to power, but Hitler used them as a propaganda thing. The reason why I think that we should have boycotted the German Olympics, even though Jesse Owens, you know, kind of shoved Hitler's face in the whole idea of Aryan supremacy, but the reason why we should have boycotted the 36 Olympics fully and we shouldn't boycott the Chinese Olympics is because the cultures are different. European culture and American culture, for that matter, Western culture, is about guilt. Guilt is the worst experience that people can feel in our culture. In Asian culture, in Chinese culture, guilt is not that big a deal. Shame is the big deal. Loss of face. That is the ultimate thing to avoid in most Asian cultures. And so by simply having the head of state not show up for the opening day, you impose shame upon them. And that frankly, I would say to an Asian culture, at least, you know, my limited understanding of them, I've lived in China. I lived in China for a month. I've spent a fair amount of time there. I've spent a lot of time in other Asian nations as well over the years, and done business for a number of years in Japan. And my sense of it is that would be enough, that might even get action. I mean, Steven Spielberg, a couple of weeks ago, coming out and saying, maybe a month ago, saying he was no longer going to participate as a creative advisor to the Olympics because of what was going on in Darfur. That was enough to cause, that produced enough shame that the Chinese the next week put together a high-level delegation to go to Sudan and say that they were going to do something about Darfur. Now, we haven't seen them actually do anything yet. But so I think this is a good first step. I think it's a very good first step. Stuart in West Seattle, Washington, listening on KTPK Talk 1090. Hey, Stuart, what's up?
Yeah, well, I think that much more effective than even boycotting the Olympics, which I think we should do, is boycotting the advertisers that pay for the Olympics. When we pay for the products that pay for the Olympics, we are funding these horrible things going on to some extent, or we're endorsing the things going on in Tibet, Darfur, and you didn't mention Burma.
Yeah, you're right. The Chinese
also,
are propping up the government of Burma.
You can talk about Burma, but one other point. You mentioned capitalism not being a political system but an economic system. I'd like to think of it more as a religion, which is competing with a religion of where you worship mammon or you worship capital, and it's an anti-Christian religion.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you on that, Stuart. Excellent point. And certainly, this so-called free market religion, what George Herbert Walker Bush referred to as voodoo economics, Reaganomics, is a arguably a form of religion, because it has never been demonstrated. To succeed, you cannot find a country in the world, and it's been tried. I mean, it's been tried in intense forms, like in Argentina, for example. You cannot find a country where the libertarian total so-called free market economics have been imposed or have been embraced where the result was success. You cannot find one. Judy in Iowa. Hey, Judy, what's up? Judy, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, Judy.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, is this Tom?
It is, and you're on the air.
Oh, great. Tom, I don't think that the Olympics should ever be used as a against athletes to punish, not only punish them, but it should never be used as an arena for political gain or protest.
But the Chinese are using it as an arena for politics. They're using the Olympics as a way of demonstrating to the world that they are, you know, fully modern and fully a good citizen in the world community and all that sort of thing. The Olympics are always political, Judy.
Yes, they always are. But it's also a place where traditionally we set aside our differences. And if a country chooses, whether it's Nazi Germany or China, to use that as an arena to position themselves as, a country that's part of the greater society now, that is up to everybody else to decide whether or not, in fact, they've actually made that statement and were successful at it. And I don't think that using a country to, you know, whether you shame them or you lay guilt on them, doesn't matter. It is not a place where we should use political ploys to leverage, China to stop it.
I'm agreeing with you that we shouldn't pull our athletes. The opening day, though, the opening day ceremonies are going to be all about all of us countries are all together and we're all on the same page and we're all good buddies here and we're all happy to be here in China. And that's the day that Sarkozy in France and Merkel in Germany are saying we're not going to show up because of what's going on in Darfur and what's going on in Tibet. The previous caller mentioned Burma. Nobody's raised that in the mainstream media that I've seen, but it should be raised as well. And that day, I would argue, is a political day, and I think that we should be boycotting that. But, you know, we can agree to disagree, I suppose. Florence in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Florence. Or Francie, excuse me.
Hey. good morning, or good afternoon, Tom. I think partially, I do agree with the first, the caller that just called, because these athletes are amateurs and they deserve to be supported and that sort of thing, and they are just end up being pawns in this whole system.
Well, as I said, I'm not suggesting that we should withhold our athletes like Jimmy Carter did to protest the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan back in whatever year it was, 78 or 76.
And my 4 and 5 year olds who want to see, you know, swimming and don't understand why mommy doesn't want to watch this because we don't want to support these advertisers or what's going on and that sort of thing. You know, it kind of gets hazy in that situation. But also I think this may be a bigger question of whether or not the IOC should be able to, give the games to a country like China.
What we should be questioning and should have been questioning and protesting a long time ago was the original decision. And I wonder what Mitt Romney's role in that was as well. Francie, thank you for the call. Scott in Gresham, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Scott.
Listen, you're right on. In fact, you tied the 60 Minutes piece, which was not directly tied to the Tibetan issue and the Olympics, right on. It has everything to do with finances and having leverage over the United States policy through our economic ties and basically holding a lot of our debt.
Right. The Chinese are owning us increasingly as a consequence of Reaganomics, as a consequence of these insane trade and domestic policies, these borrow and spend Republican policies. And they've got us now.
Right. But I wanted to bring a couple of points. The thing is that you hit the nail on the head, and I would suggest that's a future show, which is the International Olympic Committee should have never awarded this in 2001. So I went on their website and took a look at the biographies of the members of the committee, and they are all hooked up with businesses that in whole or in part make much of their money with trade with China.
What a surprise.
Now, they make money elsewhere, but the point is, if you're business people, then of course you say we don't want the Olympics to be political when, in fact, one of the biggest folks buying your goods or you're trading with is actually one of those. I want to say a few other things. One is that it's a Chinese occupation. You know how we say that Iraq is now in an occupation phase? The war is over. The Chinese have occupied an independent nation called Tibet since 1951, so I always refer to it as Tibet. 1.2 million deaths, you're right, since 1959 when the Dalai Lama fled. 5,000 monasteries and nunneries were destroyed and bombarded by the Chinese communist troops. And there's only like 20 to 50 left. So, I mean, imagine if you went to a Catholic country and destroyed 98% of all the churches.
Right.
Now,
and the remaining ones you turned into basically Disneylands. They're just there to be seen.
They have re-education camps where they make the monks swear that they hate the Dalai Lama, and then, of course, the photograph of the Dalai Lama is illegal and puts you in jail. And the last thing I'll say is a warning, which is that Tibet has 5 of the major rivers in the world flow from Tibet, feeding 1/4 of the population for water. And the CIA, little known after the communist takeover in China, funded a book called Buddha's Warriors. The Tibetans fought back and were funded by the CIA until rapprochement with Nixon in China. And so literally until the late 60s, we were actually funding freedom fighters to fight inside Tibet. And so what happened to our policy? The future is if the Chinese do not talk to the Dalai Lama, there will be a future hot war in Tibet for freedom.
Amazing. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Tom.
44 minutes past the hour.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I live right here with you. Walk the same as you do. I don't believe that we're so different. I live right here with you. Yes, I
49 minutes past the hour. So last year, Ira Knubel of the Cleveland Cavaliers wrote a letter criticizing China's policy with regard to Darfur. And he asked LeBron James, basketball star, to co-sign the letter. LeBron James said no. Why? Well, he's got a $90 million endorsement contract with Nike. Didn't want to upset China. So, you know, what's going on here? I mean, there's from the athlete's point of view, I mean, there's got to be multiple perspectives on this. Daniel in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Daniel, you were an Olympic athlete?
Yes, sir. Actually, 1980. Track cycling. Missed my opportunity to shine. And
That was the Olympics that Jimmy Carter boycotted because the Russians invaded Afghanistan.
That's correct. Okay. And although it crushed me at the time, looking back on it, I think it was the right thing to do. And I think that we should boycott these Beijing Olympics. The occupation of Tibet and what's happening to the Buddhist religion, we need to pick up the groundswell here. Look what happened in Paris yesterday. And this is an opportunity to make our point. And, in fact, I wear a Beijing 08 lapel pin with a slash through it. And I'm in sales here in Southern California. I deal a lot with the Chinese community. And, you know, it's costing me money, but it's a point that I'm willing to make. And I think as an athlete, you have to – the Olympics are political. There's no way to look at it than that. And we need to make a stand here.
Yeah. The Chinese human rights lawyer Gao Xinsheng said, and I'm quoting, he said, the Chinese communist regime sees the hosting of the Olympics as political. They are using it to prove to the Chinese people that the world is still acknowledging the party as a legal government, despite all the suppressive and bloody tyranny and all the horrible crimes against humanity the party has committed. The day after he said that, by the way, and posted it on the Internet, he disappeared.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we need to bring more recognition to what's actually going on in China and how they suppress free speech, what they do to their citizens. This is an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, this is from Ha Jin, another Chinese democracy activist. He wrote, when you come to the Olympic Games in Beijing, you will see skyscrapers, modern stadiums, and enthusiastic people. You may not know that the flowers, smiles, and prosperity are built on a base of tears, imprisonment, torture, and blood. The day after he wrote that, he was sent to prison.
Yeah, and, you know, Tom, as an athlete, as a former athlete, we have other opportunities to shine. There's world championships. There's all kinds of different competitions that athletes can compete. This is an opportunity for athletes to be political, to stand up and, you know, fight for the rights of other people.
So, Daniel, you would advocate not just Bush not showing up for the opening day games, like, or the opening day, rather, like Merkel and Sarkozy are talking about doing, but actually pulling our athletes?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, you know what? We could have. You're more radical on this than I am.
Well, you know, personally, I was hurt by what happened, but you know, and I was mad at Jimmy Carter at the time, but it was the right thing to do. It was an opportunity to, you know, tell Moscow that we were against, ironically, their occupation and invasion of Afghanistan.
Right. Which brings up the question of, you know, who are we to criticize at this point? But Daniel, thank you. Thank you very much. Excellent point. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Patty in Asbury Park, New Jersey. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Yes. Oh, this is Tom Hartman.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm great.
Listen, I was going to tell you that Bush saying anything about China might mean something to you, but nobody else in the world with knowledge of what he's done in Iraq. First of all, he's a war criminal and shouldn't even be allowed to be out of the country. He should be brought before the world court.
Yeah.
Not only did he commit, there's genocide happening in Iraq. He sponsored the Ethiopian to go in there and to invade Somalia. And a lot of people feel that what's happening in Somalia even dwarfs the Sudan. I mean, this man has lost all credibility. In fact, America has lost credibility for what they're doing. So how in the world do you expect the Chinese to really be all that moved by you, or even the protesters in London, who and with England being in Iraq alongside America? I mean, this looks hypocritical. I believe.
Well, perhaps the protesters in France have a little higher moral ground, and I think it's ironic that France, who opposed our invasion of Iraq and occupation of Iraq, is the place where. They had backdoor deals with Saddam, but they opposed our invading the country, and that is the country where twice the torch was actually put out, and I don't know of any time in modern history where the torch actually was extinguished on its path. I think that's very symbolic. So
the thing about it is that at this point, for George Bush to get up and say, "Stop the torture in China."
We all cringe. I agree, Patty. And at the same time, he does represent the American people, and I think the American people need to stand up and say something about this. Adrian in New York. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better.
Oh, good. Well, listen, I was calling in because the caller before said something about how, you know, these athletes are amateurs and we should let them compete. And my point is, you know, I'm not going to speak for every single person that competes, but a lot of them, for a lot of them, this is a multi-million-dollar career, and the Olympics has become a billion-dollar industry. It's no longer this kind of, you know, goodwill competition that it was back in the 1800s, and I really think we shouldn't paint this with such a you know, a lackadaisical kind of brush that, oh, this is just good competition between countries. I mean, it's a business. It's a multi-billion-dollar business.
Yeah.
And if we support it in China, we're supporting China, and we're supporting their death camps. We're supporting their occupation of Tibet. And, I mean, you know what? Nothing's stopping runners from running marathons. Nobody's stopping gymnasts from, you know, performing gymnastics. But we really should separate that there's a political, economic component to this. And, you know, you can have competitions, you can have, you know, athletic competitions anywhere, anytime, but the Olympics is an industry, and if we go to China, we're supporting China, and I think it's wrong.
Well, this is where, in particular, the first day, the opening day events, are highly political, and that's the day where, you know, I think that it's entirely appropriate that the United States stand up and say no. You know, we're not with you on this. Now, obviously, George Bush isn't going to do that. He makes his joke about how, you know, he's, oh, look at this. We have the haves and the have-mores. And you know, some call you the elite. I call you my base and all that kind of thing. But even though it's going to be tough for him, I think he should. Coming up next, Patrick Michaels.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Well, last month there was a fair amount of publicity about the conference that was held for folks who, you know, I guess you wouldn't want to call them global warming deniers, because that sort of has connotations of Holocaust deniers. Let's say skeptics of the idea of climate change and, you know, how it was funded and what was going on and all this kind of stuff. And I thought we'd get somebody on who was there and find out what happened and what's going on. Dr. Patrick Michaels is with us. He's a senior fellow in environmental studies at the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank. He's also a research professor of environmental sciences at the University of Virginia, visiting scientist at the Marshall Institute in Washington, D.C., past president of the American Association of State Climatologists, and program chair for the Committee on Applied Climatology, the American Meteorological Society, and Cato.org, the website for the Cato Institute. Dr. Marshall, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How come you guys are willing to risk the deaths of millions of humans, not to mention wiping out species, in exchange for more profits for ExxonMobil?
That's not exactly what's going on here. I think that, in fact, some of the policies that are being proposed on global warming could result in a lot more economic discomfort, and that leads to you know, other very bad things. If we spend all this money right now, we're not going to do anything about climate change. All we're going to do is make people miserable.
We're going to make people How would taking the United States off a carbon-based economy and putting us on, say, for example, a solar-based economy? We have more.
We can't do
more,
it.
What do you mean we can't do it?
It can't be done.
Germany's doing it right now.
The sun's not hot enough. No.
You haven't been to the Mojave Desert recently.
I understand that. But the fact of the matter is that there, and this was just in Nature magazine last week by Roger Pilkey Jr., pretty prestigious guy in this field, said, you know, we really don't have the technology to do anything substantive about climate change right now.
Well, we didn't have the technology to drop a bomb on Japan before we decided to make the technology.
People have been searching for the energy holy grail for a very long, long time. There's obviously a lot of money to be made if we can get a source of energy that is not carbon-based, that people can afford. And I assure you, if it were doable, people would be doing it right now.
But they are. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry. You drive across Germany right now, where the government is has passed laws that backstop banks so that they can give 2% interest loans to people to over a 10-year period, essentially a mortgage over a 10-year period to put solar panels on their house, and is backstopping the power companies and saying that they have to buy the metered back electricity at 7 times the retail rate over a 10-year period. And the result of that is that the power companies are making an investment in electricity by paying individuals for the solar-generated power that is equivalent over a 10-year period to the cost of building 2 nuclear power plants. And that country has already now produced electric capacity equal to bringing 2 nuclear power plants online. And about a third of all the houses that I saw when I was last in Germany a couple months ago have solar panels on them now.
Yeah, and how much did their emissions go down? That's the problem. You have a growing population. You have a population that demands energy. In fact,
it's not that their emissions didn't go down. It's that they didn't add 2 power plants. Now, in this case, they were planning on doing nuclear power plants, but there's emissions associated with that as well, with the mining and transportation of uranium.
Germany claims to have met the provisions of the Kyoto Protocol. In doing so, they would be one of 2 major nations that have done so. The other one is England, and that's because they denationalized their coal industry. But let's just say, Tom, that every nation in the world does what they said they would do under the Kyoto Protocol.
Right. We did it here in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Now, what happens is the amount of warming that is prevented, if every nation of the world does this, okay, every nation of the world, is 0.07 of a degree Celsius per half century. That number has never been in dispute. So you have all this expense, and you have nothing to show for in the climate. That's the problem with this issue.
Well, in terms of global warming, I understand, and I agree with you that Kyoto is nowhere near radical enough to deal with the crisis that we're facing. But I don't understand why you would say that cleaning up the atmosphere, cleaning up the environment, is, you know, first of all, that it's only a global warming issue, and secondly, why you would be opposed to doing that. I mean, why? It's like, you know, when you're driving alone, you're driving with Osama. Why should we have an economy in the United States based on giving money to radical, by and large, religious, you know, radical religious beholden to regimes in the Middle East?
Well, there's no relationship between the price of oil and the amount of terrorism. There's no doubt about that. However, having
there
said
isn't.
That, what's more important is this. If you really care about planetary warming, you have to reduce your emissions by about 60 to 80%. No one knows how to do that. Now, look, if we have gasoline running at about, what, $3.50 a gallon or something like that, how much has consumption dropped? The answer is very, very little. But it's starting to have substantial economic effects. Look at the economic effects of our concrete global warming policy, which is to turn
well,
warming into ethanol.
Hang on just a second. Let's just go back to the economic effects. 30 years ago in Europe, the price of gasoline was raised to the equivalent of about $5 a gallon. And by simply adding a tax, about a $4 a gallon tax on gasoline, it was even more than that, actually. And the consequence of that is that right now the average European, we're talking Western European countries, the average Western European consumes about 1/7 as much gasoline as the typical American.
And the European Union, as a whole, clearly did not meet its Kyoto targets at all.
Well,
in fact,
when you look at the European Union as a whole, you're looking at a bunch of developing countries as well. I mean, they doubled the size of the European Union since the fall of the Soviet Union. And
let's take a look at the fact that their emissions went up, despite the fact that gasoline was that expensive.
Right, that's because countries like Albania and Romania are building gas and coal-fired power plants, and they're being industrialized very rapidly and in a very dirty fashion. But if you look at the Western European countries and the Scandinavian countries, the countries that have had a long-term, that had stable economies and have a long-term commitment to a cleaner environment, you're seeing that that is not the case.
Well, I just want to know, with the price of energy as high as it is there, how net emissions could go up, and what that tells us about what would happen here. You see, okay, Tom, let's say we all want to do something about global warming, okay? Just to say that, just for the heck of it, even though some people might not. To make energy so expensive today that people could not afford it, or rather,
carbon-based enemy, energy.
Yeah, that's right. Carbon-based. To do that would require great economic sacrifice, and that would take capital away that people like you and I could use to invest in the
technology. This is the argument that the whale oil sellers were making when kerosene came along.
No. I'm telling you, it's exactly the opposite. If you really care about this, and this was take a look at Gilkey's piece in Nature magazine last week. It was really very, 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 very nice piece.
Is it a peer-reviewed really article or a letter to the editor?
Oh, no, it's a big article. It said, essentially, that it would be foolish, because you don't have the technology now. What you really, really need to do is you need to develop the technologies, and that requires capital investment. So you don't want to take away people's investment ability now in a futile attempt to stop warming.
Right, so we can invest
in it.
Right, but so we can put $100 billion a year or more into Iraq. We can give the oil companies $18 billion in tax breaks, but we don't even have $1 billion to develop this technology that you're talking about?
I'm telling you this. People, vibrant economies can invest and will invest in more efficient technologies. And unfortunately, right now, we don't. The only way you could have these massive emission reductions is, in fact, to have major effects on the economy, because energy would have to become very expensive. Even Bill Clinton said that.
That effect, though, could be very positive. I mean, this could be the dot-com boom of the next era. As we move in, every time, if you look at the history of energy, when we moved into coal, there was a boom. When we moved from coal to oil, there was a boom. When we moved from oil to gas, there was a boom. Every time, and with increased efficiencies, there's a boom. This could be it. Why? You know, other than the fact that a lot of you guys are taking money from ExxonMobil and companies like that, the coal mining associations, why try to stop it?
What you really need to do is to be able to invest in the future. And I'll offer you an example of this happening in the real world right now. I'm not going to name names today. I don't think I should.
And we just have a half a minute left. I'm sorry.
But take a look at the performance, the stock performance of companies that produce efficient cars compared to those that don't. And you will see people are already investing in a cleaner future.
Yeah, I agree. And General Motors is starting to make hybrids, and they're talking about plug-in cars and things. And so, you know, we're moving in that direction. But I just think that it's time for a new Manhattan Project. Anyhow, Dr. Patrick Michaels, the Cato Institute, cato.org. Thank you for being on with us, sir.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Hold on tight to your dreams.
Yeah, hang on to those dreams, my friends. Dreaming about a positive future, dreaming about the possible. Paul Hanneman is with us. Let's get the other side of this discussion here. Paul Hanneman is with us. He's the president of Bright Green Talent, an executive search firm that works solely in the environmental sector with offices in London and San Francisco. He taught environmental management and leadership at Oxford University. Paul is a brilliant, well-read, very, very well-informed guy on these topics, and somebody I've known for a lot of years, and Paul, it's great to have you on the program.
Well, hi, Tom. Thank you. That was very interesting listening to your last discussion, because my view is not that the environment presents a problem, but it's the greatest opportunity in the history of business. I moved to the United States 2 years ago to be at the vanguard of that. And, you know, you could look at the history of business and say that every turn we heard this argument that, oh, you know, ending slavery is bad for business, ending child labor is bad for business, giving equal pay is bad for business, giving health and safety, clean air is bad for business. Well, you know, I think dealing with the environment is the best thing for business we could ever do in the short term, medium and long term. And I've bet my career on it. And I'm a businessman. I'm an entrepreneur. I think there's a very, very strong business case for tackling climate change.
Well, and you're a very wealthy entrepreneur, and I know you travel in some fairly rarefied circles. What's the buzz among people of high net worth individuals with regard to the future of green in the United States and around the world?
Well, I was at the Wall Street Journal conference in Santa Barbara 3 weeks ago, which was probably one of the most prestigious conferences in terms of a number of CEOs. There's a CEO of Walmart there, General Electric, the top VC people in the country. And the unanimous view was that this really does represent an extraordinary opportunity, and that this is a unique opportunity to make money, to create jobs, and solve the environmental problem. It's all about harnessing the energies of business, entrepreneurship, and finance. It needs creative leadership, and there's hundreds, thousands of people, in fact, particularly in Europe, but also in the States, who are starting to move in this area. You can see that hundreds of billions are now switching in venture capital funds from traditional internet-based businesses, semiconductors, into clean tech industries. And not just solar, wind, people are looking at green buildings, a huge growth area. Energy efficiency. Everybody gets very excited about solar, wind, and biomass. But the biggest difference right now is in simply greening buildings in this country through simple steps like insulation, water conservation, products and technologies that are out there and just need the leadership to make it happen.
Right, which also brings us to the jobs. You own this company, brightgreentalent.com. You're basically hiring people for the green industry, as it were, for the eco industry. What are the green jobs out there?
Well, the green jobs, in my view, there's direct green jobs, such as installing solar panels, and there's, if you like, indirect green jobs, like corporate social responsible jobs for businesses that are, you know, promoting environmental policies. There's no clear definition, but what's interesting is that the research recently for example, the American Solar Society, believes that by 2030, one in four jobs, so 40 million jobs, will be in clean tech and environmental businesses. They see it as the biggest increase in jobs. And so I think the biggest area right now, again, is green building and in the utilities as they switch more to renewable energy. But it covers waste, water, remediation, cleaning, pollution control, conservation, environmental lawyers. These are all very high growth areas at the moment.
So if somebody is a student or somebody is advising a student, what areas should they be looking at in school? Or does this, is this so multidisciplinary? It's all these different fields are moving in that direction.
Yes, it's indeed. Whether you could be in sales, finance, marketing, law, accounting, and there will be jobs working for environmental-related businesses. There are thousands of startups and emerging companies supported by institutions now. The particular hottest areas are still solar, wind, biomass, although that's become more controversial recently, biofuels. But the two in Europe that are biggest, and we believe in the States will be biggest, they're definitely green buildings, there's no question about it. And the other one, which is a little bit more controversial, but is carbon trading and carbon offsetting, which a lot of environmentalists are still unhappy with. But there'll be new legislation almost certainly with the new president and cap and
this
trade.
This is the cap and trade.
Absolutely, which will create a lot of jobs. But what's the most interesting thing I found, Tom, when I was teaching at university and with the students I work with, is how many young people now want jobs which give them meaning, which give them purpose, where they're actually doing good. It's not enough just to go straight into Wall Street or a management consulting. They want the psychological rewards of working with people who share their values and doing good. And I think if we can tap into this, it's a very, very exciting opportunity again.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's the sort of thing that you wrote about in your book, The Magic of Groundhog Day, themagicofgroundhogday.com. Paul Hannum, the president of Bright Green Talent, brightgreentalent.com, also greenesthost.com, a green website hosting company, and previously taught environmental management and leadership at Oxford University. Paul, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. And paulhannum.com as well, I believe. 26 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Yeah, it's called Democracy, Our Dream. We're bringing it back here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Congressman Chris Shays, who the Republican from Connecticut, as I recall, who voted for the war in Iraq. Keep in mind, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives did not vote to authorize Bush to invade Iraq. It was only in the Senate where the majority of Democrats voted it makes me crazy every time I hear somebody from the corporate media go, well, you know, all the Democrats supported this war. No, sorry. In the House of Representatives, the majority of the Democrats voted against it. But the Republicans all voted for it. And one of them, Congressman Chris Shays, didn't even bother to read the intelligence, apparently.
I don't think you answered the question about whether or not you had read the classified national intelligence estimate.
No, I didn't. Thank you. I did not read it. I should have answered it. I did not read it, but I could still read it, and I probably should.
Yeah. So. Chris Shays, Congressman Chris Shays said, no, I didn't read it back 5 years ago, and I still haven't read it, and I probably should. Meanwhile, John McCain out here. Now, keep in mind, this is the guy who voted against an amendment providing $20 billion to the VA's medical facilities. This is a guy who voted against, he was one of only 13 senators to do this, voted against providing $430 million to the Veterans Administration for outcare and treatment of outpatient care and treatment of veterans. He voted against increasing the VA's funding by $1.5 billion by closing corporate tax loopholes. Got to keep those corporate tax loopholes intact, you know. He voted against increasing VA funding by ending abusive tax loopholes to the tune of $1.8 billion. These are two different years, 04 and 06, that the efforts were made by Democrats to close corporate tax loopholes and use that money for VA funding. In both cases, McCain voted against those. In 2001, he voted against a $650 million increase in veterans' medical care funding. But as Harry Truman pointed out, the Republicans, every couple of years, every election year, all of a sudden they start changing their tunes. Here's John McCain singing a whole brand new tune.
As president, I will do everything in my power to ensure that those who serve today and those who have served in the past have access to the highest quality health, mental health, and rehabilitative care in the world.
Now, he's speaking before the veterans of foreign wars, by the way.
The disgrace of Walter Reed must not be forgotten.
Yeah, except that the disgrace of Walter Reed was brought about in large part because of Senator John McCain and his votes against funding of the war, against funding of veterans and his votes for the war. And this is where it gets truly bizarre. McCain is out there saying we may be in Iraq for 100 years. And using the example of Germany, we got bases in Germany 50 years out, and completely wrong, saying that things like, well, you know, it was Sadr who called for the ceasefire. No, it was the government of Iraq that yelled uncle and said, you know, hold off, please. And, in fact, Chris Wallace had this conversation with John Kerry on Fox News over the weekend. And John Kerry just laid it right out. This, first of all, Chris Wallace.
Now, on the question of the 100 years, and you campaigned for president in 2004, I never heard you say, let's get all of our troops out of South Korea, where they've been for half a century.
Well, absolutely not.
Let me just ask. I never heard you say, let's pull our troops out of Germany, where they've been for more than half a century. That was the model he was talking about there, not 100 years of war.
Let's be very clear about this 100 years again. The model in Japan and in Korea is a model where they have adopted a full democracy and where they have none of the insurgency, al-Qaeda, jihadist, religious extremism that you have in Iraq. John McCain himself, 4 months ago, please go back and read the interview, said in answer to Charlie Rose, no, I don't envision it being possible to stay that period of time in Iraq, and we will withdraw, he said, because of the religious and cultural component. So you have a different John McCain today when he talks about 100 years or a million years.
Now, of course, John Kerry, the guy that the Republicans portrayed as Mr. Flip-Flop, when he was actually quite consistent in his positions, and John McCain flip-flopping in ways that are just mind-boggling. You know, he's against veterans benefits. Now he's for veterans benefits. He thinks that we should not stay in Iraq for 100 years because it's a whole completely different situation than Germany or Japan. And now he says, no, we should stay in Iraq for 100 years. I mean, we're talking major changes here. Major changes. And nobody's calling him on it. Nobody's calling him on it except John Kerry. And you know, I mean, here on this show, and there's a few others, but by and large in the corporate media in America today, he is simply not being called on these issues. Our phone number, 1-866-303-2270. Hey, Don Siegelman is out of jail. 60 Minutes did a little thing on him last night. Keith in Kent, Washington. Hey, Keith, you wanted to bring that topic up. Good on you for it.
Well, I'm frustrated by what appears to be, again, a corporate media blackout about the true issues. Has a governor, a former governor of a state, ever been led away from a court in shackles? Has a prisoner like this ever been shuttled between prisons? Has there ever been any true discussion of the Broward County malfeasance where he was essentially denied reelection? Has anyone ever thought to describe this man as the end of America? One of the greatest books of last year might describe as a political prisoner. He is a political prisoner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've been talking about this on this program for the better part of a year since I first became aware of it, maybe longer than that, whenever the prosecution began. And what I've been saying from the very beginning, you know, when this whole scandal came out about these fired U.S. attorneys, I said, forget about the fired U.S. attorneys. I mean, that's an interesting sideshow. What we need to do is pay attention to the U.S. attorneys who kept their jobs, like Laura Canary, the one down in who prosecuted Siegelman, whose husband was Bob Riley, the Siegelman's opponent running for governor of Alabama, was his campaign manager. I mean,
if this was a novel, it would be a bad novel.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. And then he gets sent to jail for 7 years. And denied bail on appeal. You know, I mean, they literally let him off in shackles. He gets sent to jail for 7 years because he appointed a guy, a political friend of his, who had contributed money to, not even to him, and not even to his campaign, who had contributed money to a campaign in the state of Alabama to legalize a state lottery to raise money for education. And he appointed this guy to a hospital commission that two previous governors had also appointed the same guy to. And it's an unpaid position. I mean, it's like, and for that, he gets 7 years in prison? Go ahead.
Everywhere I looked last week, I saw the same 11-sentence AP story with the discussion of the appeal was held up because the trial reporter died. So the trial transcripts couldn't be written, as if only one person had the ability to write it. The same thing with the discussion of his conviction that the Alabama Republican Party still held to the position that he was convicted by a jury of his peers. I'm just saddened that this state of affairs exists where people allow the lack of coverage to bias the viewpoint.
Yeah, the situation with Don Siegelman is
anyway,
huge.
Good on you, man, for letting me come through and talk about it when you're talking about other imperative issues.
No, well, there's a lot going on today and a lot of areas we can go with. Keith, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. 866-303-2270. Matt in Chicago. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I'm just calling with regard to Patrick Michaels you had on from the Cato Institute. Trying to maybe reframe the argument when it comes to oil consumption. I'm an urban planner here in Chicago, and you know, if we start building our communities walkably, so we can walk to our shopping needs, walk to our work, things like that, then we stop having use for a car.
Right. There's a lot of that here in Portland, for example. There's a lot of that going on. What's called mixed use development.
Right. Exactly. Mixed use. If we started doing mixed use communities, then you know we subvert the oil industry. So for especially with regard to guys like Patrick Michaels, where he says, you know, you just can't change the way we consume oil. So then we say, well, why don't we change the way we build our environment and stop using oil, or use less of it? I think that's one way to reframe the debate with these guys.
Absolutely, and well said, Matt. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Mark in Los Angeles, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. What's up?
Yeah, well, in the same thing about the environment, I don't understand why these people who are against this idea always come up with these same two arguments that say, you know, it's economically it doesn't make sense on one hand, and on the other hand, environmentally it's actually worse, when neither of those things are even remotely true, and yet they still have this place where they say them. They still say them as if they're some kind of fact. It's mind-boggling to me that you know, this kind of lie just gets said with a truth.
The thing that's mind-boggling to me is that it isn't pointed out in the media that the Heartland Institute, which sponsored this conference in New York City last month, is funded in part by ExxonMobil, and that if you want to say doing something about global warming is going to hurt the economy, there actually is an element of truth to that if you're ExxonMobil. But that's it. Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call, Mark. Thanks for listening to us there on K-Talk as well in Los Angeles. 44 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. Find out more over at teamsters.org.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm a grinner, I'm a lover, and I'm a sinner. I play my music in the sun. I'm a joker, I'm a smoker, I'm a midnight toker. I get my love in all.
Half minutes before the hour. TomHartman.com, our website for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com, the all-new reinvented website, blogs and all kinds of cool stuff. And our phone number, 866-303-2270. John in Chandler, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just want to compliment you on being so smart about this stuff. You are just about the brightest candle I've seen in a long time when it comes to dealing with these people who, you call them kindly skeptics.
Yeah, the global warming deniers.
What they're afraid of is we're going to cut into their profits, and you've got that nailed right to the wall. And frankly, if you would listen to the advertising that they have on television these days about, you know, like waste management as an example of how much greener we are than we used to be, and Chevron saying we're doing all kinds of things, even geothermal. Look at geothermal. Oh, God, let's get all excited. And if you actually find out how much of their money they're investing in that, you find out it's a pretty small amount.
Well, it would be interesting to compare it to how much they're spending on advertising. I remember back years ago, I was CEO of an ad agency in Atlanta, and one of our accounts was a major credit card company that also sold traveler's checks. And they advertised the fact that you could always get a refund on your traveler's checks. And what was interesting, and I kind of learned from being on the inside, was that they actually spent more money on advertising the fact that they would refund traveler's checks than they did on refunding traveler's checks.
Right.
And so you wonder if some of these companies that are talking about their green cred, you know, if they're actually spending more money on advertising the fact that they're doing some green things than the green things that they're doing. I don't know. But the thing that always blows my mind is when I see these ads for oil drilling platforms, you know, or for these fighter planes, you know, the ads for the defense contractors, McDonnell Douglas and Boeing, and the ads for you know, ConocoPhillips, I guess, is the, you know, what, I'm going to buy an oil drilling platform? I don't think so. They're advertising, and some people think that the ads are designed to influence public opinion. You know, Clean Coal, for example, sponsoring two of the Democratic debates, the coal industry. I think that it goes beyond that. I think that what they're trying to do is they're trying to influence the media not to talk about what they're up to. I think that's their real agenda, because it's the media that they're giving that money to. And the ads are not the kind of strong issue ads that would actually influence public opinion. I think what they're trying to influence is the executives and the reporters. And that concerns me. John, thanks a lot for the call.
Go beyond that just a little bit, Tom.
Sure.
I think if we brought back windfall profits taxes and started tapping into this $20 billion that Mobil Exxon, and not even the others, but just Mobil Exxon, $20 billion in profits last year, we would have money to do these projects. And we would have money to actually, in fact, find out how much they're doing. If they're, in fact, developing, doing R&D on all this kind of stuff, give them some credits on this this windfall profits tax. Yeah. Give them some credit on it.
Well, and let's just go back to corporations paying their share of the taxes. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, and these guys are you know, they've got some very, very smart accountants, and they know what's going on in the world. This is a quote from their annual report from 2 years ago. Quote, corporate taxes are at the lowest level since 1934, 7%, 7.4% of all federal tax receipts, down from 32% in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, the corporations in America today are paying one quarter of the taxes that they were in the 1950s. And in the 1950s, that tax money was being used to build infrastructures. And in the 1950s, the taxes of average working people were much, much lower relative to their income than they are now. As a consequence, and what's happened is we're just seeing the taxes being shifted from big corporations to you and me, and on it goes. But John, excellent point. Windfall profits tax, that would be a great place to start. Let's just go back to talking about what about the possibility of corporate income tax? Steve in Los Angeles. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Fine.
What you were talking about just a minute ago is we need to get rid of the stranglehold by the oil companies. And California is a prime example because we have four E85 stations in California where other states are running 50 to 60 to 70. And it's because they won't even let the E85 cars be smogged in California.
Right. This is 85% ethanol,
E85. Right. So
you've got four gas stations in the entire state. I mean, this is the problem that we have here in Portland is we've got a very good and strong and growing biodiesel industry, but the gas stations, which are owned by these big oil companies, they refuse to put in the pumps.
Yeah.
And they just say, no, we're not going to do it.
If I wanted to participate and buy an E85 car, it wouldn't do me any good because I couldn't even drive it in the state.
There you
go.
So
it's crazy, but
yeah.
Somehow we need to break their stranglehold.
Absolutely. Steve, thank you very much. Well said. Ron in Seattle. Hey, Ron.
Hi. In Tacoma, I was house number 12 or home number 12 that am I still on?
You are.
I was home number 12 that put solar panels on my roof, and it was your program that really got me motivated, and it was Al Gore was doing it and having a lot of trouble. I actually came online before he did.
That's great. So what's been your experience with solar panels on your roof?
Well, first thing is that you they're almost, you can't see them. I mean, they're so, they sort of blend in just like a skylight or something like that. So it's not some big ugly thing that you've got stuck out there. And then, it hasn't been quite a year yet. We went online in June, and my first thing is my power bill went down considerably, but it's hard.
Even in rainy, cloudy Seattle.
Even in rainy, cloudy Seattle. Yeah.
Yeah. The sun gets through, and that's, I mean, you know, if trees can grow, solar panels can work. Ron, thanks for sharing your experience with us. I mean, that's the bottom line. The sun does get through. Germany is about as cloudy and dreary a place as you can get. I remember the year that I lived there, there were 97 days, they were counting them on the radio, where the sun never once came out in the area where we lived in the Franconian forest in the Frankenwald. And yet, they're the world's leading user of solar power.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
Chris Matthews, quoted MSNBC's Chris Matthews, quoted right up at the top of David Brock and Paul Waldman's new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media, the quote, "The press loves McCain. We're his base." Chris, don't believe I would have said that. Paul Waldman is with us, MediaMatters.org, and his new book, Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Great to have you with us. I noticed that Newsweek this week has, it's a cover story about, you know, the environment and the presidency and all that kind of thing. And in that cover story, they quote an Obama advisor as saying that McCain is actually on a different page than George Bush with regard to the environment. But in fact, it's really not true. I mean, when you start looking into his policies, McCain is, his rhetoric is a little bit different, but he's really going down the same road. The Democratic candidates, on the other hand, have very clear, clearly defined positions on global warming, on reducing carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, et cetera, et cetera. McCain is having none of that. How is it that he gets away with these outrageous distortions of reality and the press just kind of not only goes along with it, promotes it?
It's one of the most important media stories of the last couple of decades. John McCain, more so than any other politician in Washington, understands the press, appreciates how to get them on his side, and through an extraordinarily clever strategy and well-implemented strategy, has managed to make the news media into not the kind of adversary that they often are for politicians, but almost a partner in his endeavor of self-promotion. It's been, in some ways, pure genius.
Now, the Bush administration has really perfected the old Nixonian strategy of punishing the press, or those people within the press, targeting individuals and saying to, you know, people in the White House press corps, some of the top reporters, and I put that in quotes because these people really are TV stars, and who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, in some cases millions of dollars a year, pointing out to them very explicitly that if they ask the wrong questions, if they challenge, that their careers will go right straight into the toilet because they will never be called on again and they will never get access again. McCain, that brute force, you know, use of the hammer, threat of punishment technique has worked relatively well for the Bush administration. So much so that, you know, in the first weeks right after Bush was selected by the Supreme Court, CNN sent a senior vice president up to Washington, D.C. to apologize to Bush for the way that he had been covered up to that point. But McCain has taken a completely different strategy.
Absolutely. And, you know, a president can rule the press by fear. But what McCain understood was that a senator can't do that. But he also appreciated that the normal relationship between politicians and reporters is characterized by suspicion. And what happens is politicians are always afraid of saying something wrong, saying something that's going to get them in trouble, and so they tend to be very guarded around the press and careful with their words, and it drives reporters crazy. So McCain turned that upside down. He said, okay, I'm going to return these guys' calls, even if it's 2 in the morning. I'm going to invite them into my office, onto my bus, and just talk for hours and hours and hours, never go off the record, even reveal things about myself that are not all that complimentary, because he understood that doing so would generate a kind of a reservoir of goodwill that he could then draw on, so that when McCain does say something that would get a different politician in trouble, they give him a pass. And what we also find is that they have built up this image of him, we call it in our book The Myth of McCain, that means that they're going to repeat over and over again all of these kind of phrases and words that are really crafted by his campaign. When was the last time you opened up a story about John McCain that didn't refer to him as a maverick or didn't talk about him delivering straight talk? These are the McCain campaign's catchphrases, but they are all often used by reporters in their own voices to describe him in a way that makes some of the coverage of him indistinguishable from the things that the press releases that come out from the campaign.
And the fact of the matter is he's not a maverick and he doesn't engage in straight talk.
Absolutely not. And if
give us some examples.
The real record, what you find is, first of all, that he is a firm, even staunch conservative. He votes with the Republican Party about 85% of the time, which makes him no different from almost any other Republican in the Senate. And those on those few instances where he has broken with his party, and by the way, every senator breaks with their party now and again. The difference is that when McCain does it, it's front page news, and the reporters write a very different story about that than they do when a different senator breaks with his or her party. You know, Hillary Clinton has broken with her party on a number of occasions, but nobody in the press is calling her a maverick. But when John McCain decides he's going to vote with the Democrats on something, the story fundamentally changes. And now the story that gets told by reporters is about John McCain and his courageous rebellion. We've seen that story written over and over. Even if the occasions on which he breaks with his party are few and far between, And almost always are cases in which the Republican Party is on the wrong side of public opinion. So he's not taking a political risk when he decides that he's going to support campaign finance reform, for instance, because he knows that that's where the public is. They support that too. So it builds up goodwill with the press, and it puts him in the place where the majority of the public is, and manages to cultivate this image that he's somehow this maverick who's going his own way. When
in
fact,
moderate,
he really isn't. He's a staunch conservative who votes with the Republican Party the vast majority of the time.
Yeah, you talk about manufacturing McCain in your book. What and you know, starting out in 1982 in Phoenix, and you know, I know that when he dumped his first wife and shortly thereafter married his second wife, who's worth over $100 million, that she loaned money to the campaign, and boom, all of a sudden he was a politician and a successful one. To what extent has McCain's image been the result of an intentional manufacture job versus simply his being that phenomena that some would argue Franklin Roosevelt was, or Jack Kennedy was, of just, you know, a very smart politician, a guy who or Ronald Reagan for that matter, who has a lot of charisma and personal charm and turns it on the media?
Both things are true. He is a very smart politician, nowhere more so than in his dealings with the press. But they also have, I think, more so than with any other politician, kind of burnished that image of him really intentionally ignore the things that are less complimentary. I mean, you know, we've seen it now. Just to take one very recent example, on Sunday, on Fox News Sunday, John Kerry was being interviewed. He got asked about Howard Dean, who said that John McCain was an opportunist. And what Chris Wallace, the host of Fox News Sunday, said to Kerry was he an opportunist when he refused early release when he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam? As though any question about John McCain's character, his motivations, can only be answered with the fact that he was a POW in Vietnam. Now, nobody denies that he endured great suffering during that time, but it was 40 years ago. And there's a lot of things he's done since then that might give you a different view of him, but as far as the reporters are concerned, that's the beginning, middle, and end of the John McCain character question. Any character question about him can only be answered with, he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. And we've seen that throughout his career. One of the interesting things also is that reporters are always saying how McCain doesn't like to bring Vietnam up, that he's very reluctant, too modest to ever raise it. But the fact of the matter is he's not. Now, he has every right to, but his entire career has been based on the use of his POW history for political ends. That's okay for him to do, but it's not okay for the reporters to tell us that he's not doing it, because that's what he's always done.
Right. So to the extent that Washington, the Washington reporters, the press corps, well, not just the Washington press corps, the press corps right across the board, has been seduced, I guess would be a good word, by John McCain. How do we react to this? How do we undo this? How do we unravel this? How do we wake them up from this?
Well,
it's almost like they've become members of a cult. How do we deprogram them?
Well, what we hope to do with this book is to start a conversation. And I think that you're beginning to see that more on blogs, people starting to talk about it, the idea that, you know what, he has gotten fundamentally different treatment from the press, and it has been, frankly, pretty unprofessional on their part for much of his career. And so we're hoping that people begin to talk about that, begin to look at these things. And by the way, we have a website at McCainsFreeRide.com where you can find out all kinds of interesting things about John McCain and the press. And our hope is that once this discussion gets started and the reporters who cover politics can't ignore it anymore, that they'll kind of step back and say, okay, you know, for a long time we've just been repeating over and over, he's the maverick, he's the straight talker, he's the reformer, he's the one person in Washington who doesn't do things for political expediency. Let's take a look at whether those things are really true. And maybe now that he's the Republican nominee for president, they can kind of start fresh in their reporting of him. Now, call me too optimistic, but I'm hoping that will happen.
Well, in fact, Dan Abrams on MSNBC is doing his Teflon John segment now. I think that this is kind of in response to that sort of thing. Paul Waldman, he's the co-author with David Brock of Free Ride, John McCain and the Media, the website McCainsFreeRide.com, and, of course, MediaMatters.org. Paul, you're doing great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Making politics better, we're making America a better country, step by step, day by day. And the folks over at the International Labor Rights Forum are doing the same thing, laborrights.org. Timothy Newman is the campaign assistant with the ILRF, ILRF.org as well. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And let me get this right. You guys are working on a campaign to keep provisions in the farm bill that would establish a voluntary, and that in and of itself seems rather weak, but nonetheless, a voluntary certification program regarding imports of food and products made using forced labor and child labor. And a couple of America's largest corporations are fighting this?
Yes. So Cargill and ADM, Archer's Daniels Midland, are fighting this provision. Just as a little bit of background, the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2005 directed the Department of Labor to create a public list, of goods that could be imported into the U.S., which may have been produced by forced labor or child labor. So it's basically to call attention to products that are imported into the U.S. that may have been produced under these conditions.
Right.
And this section in the Farm Bill, Section 3104, would create a voluntary certification program for those goods that are on that DOL list so that importers could demonstrate to consumers that their products are not harvested or produced with forced labor or child labor. So basically it just, you know, calls for a certification process that's voluntary that these companies can choose to go through if they want to be able to show that if they're, you know, importing goods that are on this list, that their actual goods are not produced by forced labor or child labor.
So this is a voluntary program. Why would ADM and Cargill oppose it? They could simply ignore it.
That's a really good question. So, you know, basically this is being debated right now by the House and Senate Agriculture Committee. So it hasn't become law yet, but you know, Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland found out about it, and they're fighting tooth and nail to get it removed from the Farm Bill.
Is this because they think that if, a little down the road it might no longer be voluntary? Is this is the camel's
that
nose under the tent?
Theory,
kind
yeah.
of?
And, you know, I think that, you know, when consumers see that certain companies are importing goods that are on this list of forced labor and child labor goods, you know, that's going to raise a lot of questions. So the companies are going to have to respond in some way. And so I think that, you know, if Cargill and ADM are really fighting this voluntary certification program, that raises serious questions about what kind of abuses may lie in their supply chain.
Right. Now, the legislation, the information about the legislation says that Provision 3104 of the Farm Bill would provide a step forward in working to eliminate the worst forms of child labor and forced labor around the world in conformance with existing U.S. and international law. What are these worst forms?
So the worst forms of child labor, first of all, are forms of child labor which prevent children from getting an education. And also, worse than that, they're forms of child labor which cause, you know, physical and emotional harm to children. So we're talking about kids, you know, dealing directly with pesticides that have long-term health consequences, kids who are, you know, carrying heavy loads on their back in the heat, kids who are using, you know, tools and machetes and machines that are dangerous to themselves. So it's really shocking that companies would, you know, try to defend this kind of behavior, which is internationally unacceptable.
But a company is required by law to maximize shareholder profits. I mean, that's the singular morality to which a company has to march. So I guess you can understand why these companies would be in favor of slave labor and forced labor.
Yeah, you know, it's a really complex issue, and a lot of these problems are going to take a long time to undo, but this is, you know, one just small step forward that could be used to help reduce forced and child labor. And it's really a shame. It's shocking that two of the biggest agricultural companies would be fighting this. It's very disappointing.
There was a report
a couple of weeks ago, we talked about it on this program, of slave labor down in Florida. There was a group of slaves who were freed. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, literally, people who had been held as slaves. But it's when we were in Sudan a couple of weeks ago, in South Sudan, I mean, there are parts of the world where slavery is institutionalized and if not legal, at least sanctioned with a wink and a nod. What are the countries from which we may be buying food in our supermarkets that are the worst offenders with regard to this?
Well, you know, there are so many, and as you said, it could even happen here in the United States, and it does happen here. But some of the things specifically our organization looks at in terms of forced and child labor are, the cocoa industry in West Africa, especially Côte d'Ivoire. We're also looking at sugar production in Brazil. You know, it's funny because Cargill and Archidinas Midland both signed a pact in Brazil that they would not use slavery in their sugar supply chains, and now they're fighting this provision.
And they're fighting the provision. So let your member of Congress know, Section 3104 of the Farm Bill, voluntary certification child labor status of agricultural imports, that we support it. It'd be a good step. And you can check it out over at the website of laborrights.org. Tim, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank
today.
You so much.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Let me take
minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Strange things going on out there in the world. This farmer in Belgrade, this is Serbia, a Serb farmer, his wife divorced him, and the court said that he had to split his possessions with her. Ronko Zikbov, 76, told the Belgrade Daily Courier, the K-U-R-I-R, the name of the newspaper, that, okay, he'll equally split everything with his wife, to whom he was married for 45 years. So he bought a grinder, and he cut all of his farm tools, the guy's a farmer, cut all of his farm tools in half, including cattle scales, a harrower, and a sewing machine. He says, I still haven't decided how to split the cow. She could just say which half she wants, the part with the horns or the part with the tail. Don't think that's what the judge meant, but that's what they got. Hannah Bell has posted an absolutely remarkable summary over at Democratic Underground. I want to commend this to you and recommend it to you. DemocraticUnderground.com, this blogging or posting that Hannah Bell put up. It's titled, How Reagan Created the Homeless and Why Charity Can't Fix It. And she points out that right now, there are between 2.5 and 3.5 million homeless people in the United States. We've all seen homeless people. Homeless people are part of the American landscape. Visitors come to the United States from other countries. One of the things that they often comment on are the number of homeless people that you see. And yet, some of us are old enough to remember that before Ronald Reagan, and, in fact, Hannah Bell in her commentary, she says, I left the U.S. at the beginning of the Reagan years and returned in 1985. Suddenly we had homelessness. And some of us are old enough to remember that before Reagan, there were not homeless people. The last time that we had, quote, homeless people in the United States was the folks during the Great Depression. You know, the Hoovervilles, they're back. And so she goes back and says, you know, where did this come from? How did this come about? The budget in 1978, this is pre-Reagan, for Housing and Urban Development, HUD, was $83 billion, the annual budget. 3 years after, 2 years after Reagan was sworn in 1983, that $83 billion budget had been cut to only $18 billion. That same year, general public emergency shelters
began opening in cities nationwide, as Hannah Bell writes. And in fact, in 1987, the Stuart B. McKinney Act was passed, providing $880 million in homeless assistance funding in 2004 dollars. So basically what Reagan did is he cut $65 billion of housing money out of the budget and replaced it with $880 million, less than $1 billion, for shelters for homeless people. He created homelessness. You combine that with 35 years of wage stagnation, the recession, the Paul Volcker recession back, you know, during the Reagan era, followed by a series of recessions promoted by an economy promoted by Alan Greenspan, who has now, by the way, come out as a Republican and endorsed John McCain. Alan Greenspan, who made it clear in an interview with the Wall Street Journal that he felt that his job as head of the Fed was to prevent what he called wage inflation. In other words, every time the economy got heated up a little bit, he had to slow it down so that people, there wouldn't be so many job openings out there that workers could start organizing or demanding higher wages. And then, you know, you've got this huge gap between the wealthy and the poor that has been exacerbated by things like, you know, Reagan's or Bush's tax policy. You've got a huge rise in the cost of medical care and higher education, far above the inflation rate. The decline in the percentage of the population, these are Hannah Bell's points, the decline in the percentage of the population with medical insurance and guaranteed pensions. And this is the big one. This is what Robbie Botcher was talking about last Friday. The substitution of credit as a way for people to maintain their lives and their lifestyle for income. Used to be you could have one single, you know, salary, one single wage in a home, and you could pay for, you know, one single wage earner could put their kids through school, at the end of 20 or 30 years have their home paid off, every couple of years buy a new car, and, you know, basically have what was referred to as the American dream, the middle class. And now that ain't so. In fact, now even with two incomes, it's difficult to do that, and people are having to use their homes as ATMs or use their credit cards, living off their credit cards. And all of this has been a very deliberate process. Now, what Hannah Bell doesn't point out, and that what I would like to add to this, is why. Why is it that the conservatives would want to destroy the American middle class? And the answer is really pretty straightforward. It's not greed. Because many of the people who are behind this are not, you know, the captains of industry. They're not the robber barons. The robber barons are making out very well, thank you very much, and they're helping the politicians and all that kind of thing. But it's not greed. It's ideology. And it's not just ideology. It is the belief, the fundamental belief, that a middle class is a bad thing. And a strong middle class, an empowered middle class. And the reason why is because there have been two periods, and conservatives will point this out, by the way. Sir Edmund Burke wrote about this in the 1890s. Alan Greenspan talks about it. There's no shortage of conservative thinkers. Even William F. Buckley has referred to it tangentially. That there have been two periods of a strong middle class in the United States, the 1760s, 1770s, and the 1960s, 1970s. They were produced by different things. The one in the 1700s was produced by cheap labor, slavery, and by a lot of essentially free resources, land stolen from Native Americans. But it produced a strong middle class. And the middle class of the 1960s, 1970s was the result of the policies of the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. Building the middle class. And in both cases, what came out of that strong middle class was unrest. In both cases, what came out of that strong middle class was people getting uppity, basically. People standing up and saying, you know, women saying, hey, we want our rights. African Americans saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, what happened to, you know, after the Civil War, it was supposed to be, you know, and the Civil Rights Act, and we thought, and gays saying, hey, aren't we part of the human family here? And other minority groups saying, you know, we demand our rights. People standing up and saying, enough already. of this small conservative elite, you know, basically white men running the country. And so the conservative elite looks at that and says, you know, the 60s and 70s were a pretty awful time. It was a time of great unrest. It was a time of great instability. That was not a good thing for democracy in their mind. Now, Jefferson looked at this. Jefferson looked at the instability of the 1760s and 1770s when there was another strong middle class that rose up against England and said enough already. And he looked back at the time of the Enlightenment and before that, 200 years before that, at the time of the Renaissance, when there were middle classes that emerged, again, for very different reasons. The Enlightenment middle class emerged largely because Europe was able to steal the resources of all the gold from South America, whatnot. The Renaissance in the 1400s emerged because there was such a high demand for labor because the Black Plague killed off a third of Europe, and it drove the cost of labor up, which created a leisure class, a middle class anyway. But nonetheless, Jefferson looked at that ferment, at the protest, and said, this is a good thing. These are like growing pains. These are like birth pains. This is a healthy thing. This will lead to democracy. This is a positive thing for our country. And the conservatives back in his day, Sir Edmund Burke, John Adams, talking about the rabble and how terrible it is, they said, no, this is a bad thing. And that's what Ronald Reagan said. I mean, Reagan did away with free college education in California because he said, why should I pay to have somebody go protest things I don't agree with? And so he did away with the middle class. It's very simple. And thus the problem. I mean, this is the absolute disaster. Justin in Ann Arbor. Hey, Justin, we've got just a minute here before the break. Quick point you wanted to make?
Yeah, I would just, Tom, I love your show. And I'd just like to say that there's got to be some connection to the lack of the middle class after the late 1960s, where the government stepped in and said that the unions were not allowed to directly contribute to the government.
Well, it went beyond that. I mean, Reagan declared war on unions. 25% of the American workforce was unionized when Reagan came into office, which meant that half of all American workers had the equivalent of a good union job, because wherever there's a good union job, there'll be another one that's identical to it, because the companies have to compete with union companies for workers. 25% of the American workforce was unionized when Reagan came into office. It's now, of the private workforce in the United States, it's now about 8%. And
well, when you stop the unions from allowing to directly contribute to the campaign, cut me off.
Yeah, it reduced. Certainly, that reduced union power. No, you're absolutely right, Justin. That reduced union power. But I'd say that it goes way beyond that. There has been a war against organized labor in the United States. The Labor Department is now advising companies on how to bust unions. You've got a $1 billion industry in the United States of private corporations teaching other companies how to bust and prevent unions. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Starts in my toes, makes me tinkle my nose. Wherever it goes, I always know that you make the smile. Please stay for a while now, just take your time.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. And Ellen, we've been today, we were talking with Paul Waldman, who, along with David Brock, has a new book out about John McCain called Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. And there's a big story over at Raw Story about his using an expletive to describe his wife in a tirade, I guess it was 16 years ago. I'm curious what your take is on the media's romance with John McCain and whether it will survive this presidential campaign.
I don't know whether it's going to survive it. John McCain has been good to the media as opposed to other candidates. Mm-hmm. And I liked McCain in the year 2000. I thought he was a straight talker. The people who were on his media bus full time said by the time it came to the Republican convention in Philadelphia in 2000, they were calling it the Double Talk Express. So I don't know that all the media has been completely wowed by him. I think that he has been tempered by politics, and I think that he is not as straight-talking as the guy used to be 8 years ago. But I think that there are still some media that see him as one of the most open people to media. And, you know, it's interesting because I've told this to people both in the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before that. People don't like to be mistreated, whether they're press or the man in the moon.
Right.
And McCain's people treat press extremely well. So I'm not sure if they have stars in their eyes, but people like to be treated not as if they're dirt. And
yeah.
McCain has been very good that way.
Interesting. Interesting. So what's up in the news today?
Okay. Well, first of all, Byron Dorgan was just on the Senate floor just a few minutes ago. He has been, as you know, one of the people on Iraq contracting, and he called for the General of Army Sustainment Command to come to Congress and explain some awards for Afghani arms contracts. And he wants to talk about the contracting process and how these awards come, and he would like to call them before committee. We'll see what happens if he has any luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, if they show up, I mean, there's still a whole long list of folks, starting with Karl Rove, who have been subpoenaed and never showed up, right?
I think we're not going to see people before the end of this administration. I think they're going to figure they'll run out the clock.
Yeah, I agree.
But what will happen if there's a Democrat and the Democrats in the White House and the Democrats are still in Congress? I think some of it's going to be very difficult to run out that clock.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be very interesting to watch, and you know, we need to, my listeners and I, you're in the press, it's not your job, but I think that Americans who really care about American values need to be sure to hold the Democrats responsible for holding these guys responsible even after they're out of office. This horrible precedent that was set by Ford pardoning Nixon and then Clinton stopping the prosecutions of Iran-Contra, you know, when he came into office against the Bush and Reagan administrations, of just, you know, letting the previous administration get away with, you know, murder. I mean, you know, get away with whatever it is. I think it was a terrible precedent.
Well, speaking of getting away with things, as you know, Hillary Clinton let go of Mr. Penn yesterday because of the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. Today, the president pushed on that in a very lengthy statement and talk about this. He said that the agreement would increase U.S. security. This is the Columbia Free Trade Agreement. He said it's one of our strongest allies in the Western Hemisphere, that the agreement would strengthen our economy, and almost all of Colombia's exports enter the United States duty-free, and that American exported products face tariffs, and that this would help that. He also said that he believes that the Colombians have tried to address some of the U.S. concerns about workers, and that he sort of went on and on along that vein. But then Harry Reid and then Hillary Clinton really went out on it. Harry Reid said that Bush has made numerous bad decisions during his administration that have already cost countless American workers jobs, and they have a profound harm to the U.S. policy. So that went on. So Columbia Free Trade Agreement is sort of top of the hit parade today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meanwhile,
Go ahead.
Secretary Henry Paulson was making an address today to the American Inter-American Development Bank, and he said that we need to integrate more of the Latin American community to us. So they were singing the same tunes on all of that today.
Now, Hillary Clinton cut loose Mark Penn around this Columbia Free Trade deal. How important was he to her campaign? What is the consequence of that going to be for her and for her campaign?
Well, I think that he has been very important. I think that there has been a lot of sniping within the campaign about him. So I think there's a lot of people happy to see him go. But his firm is still doing the polling. So how much influence does he not have anymore? In other words, he's still going to have a lot of influence. He's not going to have the name, and maybe it'll be his associate that does more of the talking to the campaign, but I still think they're going to be very involved.
So you think this might be more style than substance?
Style than substance.
A symbolic act of sorts.
I know if a Clinton person heard this, they'd come back at me and say, no, that's not true. He's really gone.
Right.
It is more style than substance. But there, you know, the problem with part of the Clinton campaign has been that there's been a lot of backbiting and fighting, not so much in the Obama campaign. And that has not been good for the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. Ellen Radner, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and you can find all kinds of great audio and the stories of the day over at talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up Tuesday on the Tom Harbin program, I'll confront Dr. Deal Hudson, McCain's surrogate, about his meeting with Reverend John Hagee and why he's trying to whitewash him as a nice guy. Plus, I'll be challenging Regina Herzinger, the senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute Center for Medical Progress, about universal health care and why Republicans don't want it. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.